I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Instead, she's like carrying on like an absolute pickle.
Hello, Renee.
Why do you say it like that?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When your skin feels nourished and glows, you radiate confidence. Osea makes giving your skin a glow-up easy with their clean, clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This seaweed-powered duo features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
Like you're, I don't know, you're in an echo chamber.
I'm thinking ahead to the beer that I'm going to drink after we are done recording this.
I don't know if I have a beer in my fridge, but I have a lot of wine. I have a lot of rosé, and I have a lot of Prosecco.
It's the summer of rosé, so I guess I'll take one of those.
And I think I may have drunk the last beer last night with my neighbors.
Let's get our minds around what's about to happen. It is the final Grand Slam of the year. We've had an incredibly interesting tennis season so far. And we have so, so many things to discuss, including a number of questions from people who listen to our podcast. So thank you for listening. Thank you for asking questions. Keep it up. Where should we start?
Well, first of all, I just want to say how great it is for the both of us to be in our city for a Grand Slam.
Yeah, of course.
You don't even need to sleep on my couch, which is great because God knows you did during Wimbledon.
Yes.
Lucky a little because you fit really well.
Thank you.
Okay, well, yeah, let's get into the last Grand Slam, I mean, of the year. It's pretty amazing, actually, when you think about it, what sort of happened and transpired again in women's tennis, that we don't have a dominant world number one. We don't have a dominant player. We've had a number of different Grand Slam winners again. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Halep is a reoccurring Slam champion over the last couple of years, like Kerber. But, you know, we had Ash Barty at the French and Naomi Osaka, of course, back-to-back US Open, Australian Open. How's she going to do at this US Open? It's been a tough grind for her since winning the Australian Open.
Yeah, although now she's back in number one. And
she is back in number
looking
one.
Looking to regain form.
Which is one of the sort of Twitter fights that I had over the last couple of weeks.
Oh,
you know,
geez.
How I like to have those Twitter fights. But, you know, one of the things that I brought up on Twitter was that, you know, everybody losing their mind about Naomi Osaka losing a match and then still being number one at the end of the week. Like, you guys have to remember, she has points on her ranking of winning the Australian Open and winning the US Open. I mean, those are enormous amount of points. It's very hard to catch somebody when they've got two Grand Slam titles in their pocket.
Well, let me stop you just for a second, because I think what people don't understand, and I don't understand it very well, is how it changes so much week to week. So can you talk a little bit about how the points fall off if you don't defend, if you did well in a certain part of the year one year, and you don't do as well in that same part of the year it's considered you having failed to defend your point. So is that what it is?
Yeah, so it's a 52-week rotation, for example. So there might have been a period, maybe Naomi, I'd have to look at how she did, for example, at the tournaments when she dropped and when she went to one. And you think about Ash Barty, for example, who didn't have a ton of points to defend in the middle part, or actually at the start of the year, to be honest. She had a good year last year, at the beginning. She had a really great end of the year. But she had a good, solid year last year, but it wasn't like there was no standout, like, you know, victory. Then all of a sudden she wins Miami, okay? So she adds X amount of points, a huge amount of points on her ranking there. And she has a really solid run throughout that. And then she wins the French Open, which is a huge amount of points that she's added on. Now, for example, Halep, who had the French Open points on her ranking, they dropped off, you know, because she didn't win the French again. So she goes from, I don't even know, let's take a guess, 5,000 points, and bang, loses 2,000 points right there. If you don't make at least the semis or the final, you're winning a great, huge amount of points that are on the calendar.
Right.
So
maybe the best way to think about
it is... And then Halep also won Canada.
Right.
Okay, so she won the French Open last year and she won Canada, which are two huge tournaments on her. And she didn't defend those points, but she won Wimbledon, right? So she put the points on that she lost in the French, okay, this year. And someone like Ash Barty, who didn't have to defend a lot of the points from last year, has added a huge amount of points. Now, Naomi, for example, I don't know what she's going to drop to if she doesn't win the US Open. Right. Certainly, if she makes the finals, that'll help her. It'll buffer some of the points that she will lose. But then you'll see her drop probably, I don't know, 5 or 6, you know, ranking spots.
Got it.
But she still has the Australian Open points on her
record. So she won't drop too far.
She won't drop too far because she has the defense. She has the Australian Open points on her.
So it sounds like, not to get too, you know, particular about this, but it sounds like what it is essentially like a hovering number or maybe a race, and people can pull ahead or fall behind, but it's not so much so that the rankings take immediate effect vis-a-vis your results in one particular match or two, which is why I think so many people were so sort of shocked.
Because they're like, well, how can she's been playing so terrible all year? I'm like, yeah, but she has 2 Grand Slam titles on her on her ranking still. And unless somebody does that same thing, for example, that's why Ash was able to overhaul her, because Ash put on, she had the win in Miami and the win at the French Open. Those points catapulted her over Naomi, because Naomi maybe lost a couple of points that she had made up over the French Open time.
Right, and Naomi presumably did not do well at last year's French Open either, so that period of the year was probably pretty weak for her. Okay, so going into it, in terms of the women's side of the draw, it's super fascinating to me. I mean, I am always usually more excited about the women's side, just because we do have such a rotating cast of characters who can go deep. There's a super, super interesting contrast in styles. And, you know, obviously having had 3 different women win 3 different slams, Naomi in Australia, we had Halep at Wimbledon, and then between the two of them we had Ash Barty at the French. So, you know, any one of those 3 is your favorite? Is there a favorite? Is that even a relevant question in the women's side of the draw?
No, there's no favorite. Yeah. There truly is no favorite going into, you know, Halep was the favorite at the French because she was defending champion, but also she would say that, you know, clay is her favorite surface.
And she had made a final before, 2 finals before.
And look what she did. She won on grass at Wimbledon, you know, so there's just no predictability in women's tennis anymore. I mean, Ash Barty would have said, if you would have said to her, all right, you're going to win either the French or Wimbledon prior to one of those 2 sets, and I said to her, no, you are going to win one of them, which one would you think it would be? She would probably say Wimbledon.
Right.
So, you know, it's now just proving to you that, first of all, the surfaces are all bloody blending into the same as far as speed of court is concerned. I mean, even the grass is slow. But it just shows you the depth of women's tennis. And if somebody has a little bit of an off day, people are now willing to step up and win those matches. And so it's huge. I mean, one of the most consistent players at slam level really over the last 2 years has been Serena.
Sure.
You know, she's been in the finals now back to, you know, Wimbledon. She's been in the finals of US Open last year. She made, you know, a deep run in Australia, lost that, you know, heartbreaking match with Pliskova. But, you know, she's there.
Yeah.
And she's probably my favorite to win, if she can physically handle it, to win the US Open, because you have to pick somebody who's done it 23 times and who's also been in the final a number of times since coming back.
Yeah.
Emotionally, can she handle it and win a 24th? And this is a big one. US Open's always been the hardest emotionally for her to win, because there's so much of her time is pulled aside doing other things here.
Yeah.
And obviously she wants to win in the United States more than anything. So it would
make... And it was the site of her first slam at age 19.
Yeah, and she wants to desperately win one as a mom and yeah. obviously equal the record. So there's a lot on the line for Serena, but she's still, if I had to pick one person as my favorite, it would be her.
Yeah.
But she has an interesting first round against Maria Sharapova. So all eyeballs will be on that. Listen, Serena will dominate the match, I feel. She's dominated the matches over Maria. Maria has barely played, you know, matches this year. So that in itself is, if you have to pick a winner, I mean, you have to pick Serena by a long way. But just the fact that the intrigue of the relationship of those two and, you know, what they've brought to women's tennis over the last 10, 15 years, which is, you know, an enormous amount of spotlight. It just, you know, ESPN couldn't be happier.
Well, I saw something insane where a lot of fans were saying, oh, it's rigged. The USTA rigged it.
It's not rigged, people. No, trust me. They don't want Maria and Serena playing in the first round.
No
they
way.
Want them
they
playing
want
in the quarters.
They want popcorn for the, each of them to have their own night session separately and yep. then meeting, as you say, in the quarters. The same thing with Djokovic and Federer, and we'll get to the men in a minute, but the same thing with them being in the same half. Like, yeah. oh, how can you believe it? It's like, well, because that's their seedings.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like so...
No, it's believe me when I tell you people out there. This is what I say on Twitter. Okay, I go, here we go again, kids. Okay? It's not rigged. Okay? So let's just get that straight. All right? All right, good. But it'll be interesting. It'll be a great Monday night viewing for us tomorrow night.
I will be there. I mean, look, elections are rigged. Reality shows are
it's
rigged.
It's fake news, Caitlin.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's
don't fake start news. With that. But what we can say with certainty is the U.S. Open draws are not rigged.
No.
Let's get into some coaching news. You yourself have some news.
Yeah. I got a call a couple of weeks ago from my old buddy, I should say my old mate, Sam Stoza. She's just looking to, you know, get a little bit of advice, a little bit of help throughout the rest of this year, see if she can get a singles ranking back. We'll give it a go and see what we can come up with together. And, you know, she just wanted to have someone that she trusted and respected to help her out a little bit through the end of the year. So we'll see what we can do. Hopefully it will result in some good results for Sam over the singles over the next few months. And if not, then she'll reevaluate where she's at. And obviously also she's in, I think, fourth or fifth in the race in doubles. So I'm handy to have around as far as helping with doubles as well. So yeah, it'll be fun. I'm excited about trying to help her out. And yeah, as I said, she's one of my really good friends. So
I mean, listen, we had an incredible episode where you talked with Sam behind the scenes. And you know, one thing that I think I've asked you before, and I know a lot of people are very curious about, is how do you join a team mid-year and kind of what perspective do you bring to anything? So obviously you're not changing any mechanics, you're obviously not, you know, doing anything that
I'm changing would... some mechanics.
Are you really in the middle of the season, like before,
of course we worked on our volleys over the last week or two and, you know, just sort of pointing out a couple of things that just to make things a little bit more clear in her head. I'm constantly always you know it doesn't matter how old you are and how long you've been out here, you're always tinkering with getting better. I mean, look at Roger. I mean, his backhand, for example, over the last 4 years has been
shorter
incredible.
Shorter backswing,
and I think that's coming from Lubicic. I really believe that Lubicic has made a resounding difference with Roger Federer's backhand because Lubicic's, you know, his backhand was so beautiful and he took it on the rise so well that I think he's influenced Roger in how to hit that shot better. There's no doubt in my mind. We're always tinkering around with stuff. And then another interesting coaching situation is, of course, Kamal Murray is back with Sloane Stephens. I had a feeling that was going to happen at some point. I just think that, you know, when you've had a really good relationship, it's not to say that it's going to work again. Sometimes it's like, you know, when your partner cheats on you and you think, oh, I'm going to make this work, and you give it a good old try again, and then you realize, no, I really did cheat on you for a reason. I hate you.
Cool. This is the relationship advice portion of the podcast already.
Oh, yeah. Well, anyway. But, good luck to them. Yeah. But, you know, we'll see what happens. Obviously, she's been in and out. You know, had a couple of different... She had Sven Grunfeld she was working with for a little bit. But sometimes it's just... You just take the advice. You just take the... You just get a better feeling with certain people. And I think that her and Kamal, obviously... I don't know, they hit a wall there for a little bit, and Kamal's really busy with his academy in Chicago, and, you know, maybe Sloane wanted him on the road more and maybe he couldn't provide, but bottom line is that, you know, they work really well together.
Yeah.
So we'll see if that turns out to be a good move for her. She's got a pretty tough draw at the US Open throughout, but, you know, everybody knows when Sloane gets on a roll, ooh, boy, is she good. So obviously for American tennis, I mean, I said when she made the finals of Paris, I thought she could win upwards of 5 Grand Slams, singles Grand Slams. She's good enough to win on any surface, and particularly on hard court. So, and on clay, I mean, she proved that at the French. So I think it's a good move, so we'll see what happens.
Let me ask you just a coaching question, because I have my own opinions, especially in what I love so much about hearing on-court coaching during televised matches, is you get some insight into what's going on in players' heads. Obviously, you're right there with them. And I have to say, I was pretty underwhelmed by what Jermaine Jenkins was talking to Naomi Osaka about over the summer. You know, he was her hitting partner for a while. He was Serena's hitting partner for a while. He comes from the Jenkins family, many of whom I know and love because they're Atlanta guys, and there's five brothers overall, a couple All-Americans, a couple played, you know, lower level on the tour. You know, and after Australia, where Naomi decided to stop working with Sasha Bajin, which, you know, having won two Grand Slams in a row was an eyebrow-raising question, an eyebrow-raising decision, certainly. You know, I was sort of wondering what exactly, you know, what kind of hands she was in with Jermaine, who's never coached anybody before.
So I haven't heard any of his on-court coaching. Yeah. So what was your...
She was smiling and kind of trying out a newer, less dour kind of on-court demeanor. This, I think, was in Toronto or perhaps
Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, and won a pretty tight first set tiebreaker, 7-5. And he said, "I don't know what you're out here smiling about. Do you have nothing to smile about? You know, I need you to take this more seriously." She dumps the second set and kind of shrugs off his advice, regains her sort of giggly, kind of like having a good time form, and goes on to sort of dominate in the third and win the match. And I thought to myself, now, why would you say something to derail a winning player's... If somebody's winning in a match, it seems like a dumb time to sort of offer countervailing advice. It's not the only time I heard him sort of not offer much, or in this case, I would say maybe offer something that I would perceive to be kind of counterintuitive, certainly.
Well, I think... Okay, so I obviously...
That's just one anecdote.
Obviously, I didn't see it, so I don't want to comment on, you know, Jermaine and what happened and what didn't happen and if it was right or wrong. The one thing that you have to know as a coach is how does your player play their best tennis? And if it is being relaxed, if it's being giggly, if it's being a certain way, then you have to allow them to be that way, and you have to recognize that. If it's sometimes a player gets a little bit, you know, with Carolina, for example, you know, sometimes, you know, she would lose a little bit of focus. And with the way she plays, the more focused and more aggressive she was, the better she would play. So there are times that you had to sort of lighten the situation up and make them feel like the world is not falling. But also at the same time, there are times where you've got to refocus them. So it just depends on knowing your player. I mean, you have to know where's your player's best tennis going to come from. Is it going to be relaxed? Is it going to be super focused? Do they have problems with like taking walkabouts, as we say, you know, and like three games go by and they haven't hit three balls in the court, and you're just like, what the fuck
happened? Very familiar with walkabouts in my own
game. But you know, it happens. So you might need to go out and be like, yo, we need to refocus now.
Get back.
Because we know that you can only have a 30-minute span of concentration.
Yeah.
So let's refocus now on another 30.
Right.
So that might be the case. I don't know. Obviously, that's their dynamic. And if he thinks that she needs to refocus and not be. Having said that, if you look at the match and you feel like, maybe she's better when she's relaxed and she's having a good time and she's enjoying herself. I don't know. So it's a very individual thing.
I'm going to add just one more thing, which is after Naomi kind of had this period where she went through a pretty rough stretch right after, you know, basically the tour came back to Europe and the States back in early, you know, March or so, she really hadn't had many results up until basically the last couple of weeks on the U.S. Open series where she kind of seemed to put it together. And towards the beginning of refinding her game, she posted a lengthy note on social media basically saying, hey, you know, I feel like it's important for me to be honest about this. I have had a really rough time. I haven't been having fun out there. I think it's really showed, and I want to be the kind of person who
enjoys it.
And when I'm having, you know, a good time, that's the best space for me to be in mentally. And I've started to enjoy it again, you know. So thanks for bearing with me. And I'm always trying to, you know, work on my game, and I'm a work in progress, which I thought was very vulnerable and cool for, you know, especially as how young she is, but also sort of an indication that she had been in a headspace that was very sort of negative.
Great and fantastic, but on the other hand, I'm like, I wish some, you know, she would just like not care about what everyone thinks, you know what I mean? Just who cares? Like, she's, you know, in her, what is she, 20?
20.
I mean, you know, look, she's got so much potential and upswing. I would just be like, look, you know, let's just keep working hard. That's it. Just keep working hard. The results will come. You're too good to not have another result. I mean, she's won two Grand Slams at 20. It's phenomenal.
She's phenomenal. I mean, yeah, it's phenomenal. And I think, you know, it's probably just your standard growing pains of somebody who's not only 20 in any context of their lives trying to get it together, but also somebody doing it under a microscope on a very high stage, being the number one player currently in the world. This brings up two kind of related subjects, one of which is on-court coaching. You know, you mentioned to me ESPN extended their broadcast coverage, as everybody knows who listens to this. ESPN, you're a voice in everyone's ear for the duration of the 2 weeks that the main draw is happening. But this year they broadcast and provided commentary for the week before.
It was great. It was great. And we had some great matches. You know, even our, we finished off with Asia Muhammad losing 7-6 in the third in her match, but we followed it right till the end. And we were supposed to be off air 2.5 to 3 hours before that, and we covered it for another 3 hours. So, you know, it's a collaboration really with the USTA and making, you know, concerted effort with ESPN to really showcase more of tennis. And it was great. We got to have access to the players. We interviewed so many players the whole week and got access to them on the practice court and off the practice court, and it was really good. And players are a little bit more relaxed because they're in a practice week, they're not in matches, so they don't, you know, when they're playing matches, they're being asked and prodded to do so much, and their days are long, so it was really, really great for us. The on-court coaching was really interesting because you had players like walking over and talking to their coaches, and some weren't even taking timeout breaks and sitting down and, you know, would prefer to get coaching. And then, you know, we had the most dramatic match I think I've ever seen in my whole life, with Sasha Vickery playing Shinnikova, who went down to the wire 7-6 and third in an incredibly hot day, probably the hottest day we've had in New York this year, and that went for God knows how long. But Sasha Vickery through this match was just, I honest to God, she seriously needs to like reevaluate her career. Because, I mean, from 2-1 in the first set, she is smashing rackets. It's 2-1.
Wow.
Like, you know, and like banging rackets, and she, you know, eventually finally got a warning. And, I mean, she's losing her fucking mind on the court. I mean, that's coming from me. I mean, I used to lose my shit sometimes on the court. But, I mean, I was watching this going, you cannot act like that on the tennis court from the first, second or third game
on. What's going on? Is this
and then to top it off, it's like 5-all in the second set, and she's at love 15. So she's potentially, you know, 7 points away from winning the match. The girl hits a horrendous drop shot. She runs up, has the whole court. She misses it long. Now, okay, it's shit. You want to be love 30. I get it. But it's 15-all. It's not the end of the world. Like, you still can win this game and then hold and the match is over. And she did not let go of missing that forehand for the entire game. Mm-hmm. I mean, yelling out loud, like, how could you miss that? And then she was like, you know, she'd lose a point to go 30-all, and she'd be like, see, you've given her an opportunity. And it's just like, oh my God, as a coach, I'd be like, I'm done.
Yeah.
Like, seriously, if you can't let go of that point at 5-all, and you're all you're doing, and Pearson, by the way, her opponent was losing her shit, and you're just let the door open again. So, and then the tiebreak started, and then it was 6-4 in the third, and in the tiebreak, and the girl played an unbelievable point, and she thought she'd hurt her leg, but a lot of us think it was a cramp. Then they called the physio out, and the physio deemed that it could possibly be a, you know, torn muscle, so they treated it, and Vickery's losing her shit, yelling from the other end, it's a cramp, it's a cramp. I mean, but it was like, honestly, Caitlin, when I tell you there was 3 or 4 players watching the match text messaging me saying, what the fuck is going on out there? This is a drama like I've never seen in my whole life. And I'm telling you, of course, the trainer came out, had treatment, they played another really long point, and the girl won the point, and Sasha Vickery is just beside herself, goes 6-all and loses 8-6 in the tiebreak. Now, to summarize all of that, bottom line, was it a bullshit move from the player? 90% of the people will say yes, 10% will say maybe she did tear a muscle, like who knows, she said she had torn it before and it felt the same. You got to give her the benefit of the doubt. But as a player down the other end, it shit happens, and you got to play, and you still have match point. And she loses a point, but she didn't lose the match there. Like, Sasha, you lost the match at 2-1 in the first when you're throwing your racket. Like, there's a reason you're ranked 100 and something in the world. I mean, going to be really brutally honest. You cannot act like that and think that you're going to be a good tennis player.
Well, what's interesting to me is that, you know, obviously it's the last round of qualifying, so everybody has their sights set on making the main draw, a huge monetary boost that comes just from making a main draw.
Yeah, $50,000.
I mean, it's not a joke. You know, that's some... That makes up the bulk of what a lot of players can take home in a year, right?
Yeah.
But it is interesting because we started this part of the conversation about on-court coaching. Where was her coach?
Oh, he was there. Was at 6-5, she went over to the side and he was like on top of her telling her stuff, and she's crying her eyes out and like yelling and screaming. I'm like, what, you think this is going to help you?
Yeah.
I mean, you still got, by the way, you still got match point, you know.
Right.
Like, two of them. Match point.
Yeah.
You are at match point.
Yeah.
Like, okay, let it go. Sit there and get yourself, regroup and say, okay, she's hurt herself or she's cramping. I'm going to win this match.
Well,
on Twitter was all summer.
Yeah.
It's been good.
Has it?
Yeah, it's been good.
Is this good for your
psyche?
Okay.
Because, listen, one of the things that Serena said at the US Open last year was how she felt men get away with more stuff. Okay, you could argue that for and against, all right? You know, look, some of the stuff that she did, you know, she has to own, and she has owned it to a certain degree. Some people think she hasn't, like you. But look, she lost her shit, and she paid the price in the end.
Sure,
she lost her shit.
She lost the match.
She got fined a lot of money, and she lost the match. Yeah. Okay, but she has a point. So I'm sitting in Washington, D.C. this year. I'm courtside at the tournament, and I'm sitting watching Stefanos Tsitsipas. Tsitsipas breaks a racket right in front of me, literally, and goes to the chair and changes his racket out. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Crickets from the umpire.
Nothing.
Crickets.
No warning.
Walks back, starts another point. No fucking warning. Yeah. I'm like sitting there going, what is going on with my life here?
Yeah.
Okay? Okay, so that's one. And then he's playing Nick Kyrgios in the semifinals. He takes a ball and, I mean, rifles it like a dart into the stands.
Wow.
Into the stands. I mean, I'm like, oh my God. I'm thinking, this better get out of the stands or this could hit somebody.
Yeah.
Okay? Some guy catches it in the crowd. Catches it with his hand. Thank God.
Yeah.
Crickets.
Nothing.
Crickets from the umpire. I look at the ATP supervisor, literally, that I'm sitting next to, and I go, tell me he's getting a warning for this.
Yeah.
He'll get a warning. Crickets.
Nothing.
No warning.
Yeah.
And you know what the umpire's excuse was? The guy caught the ball.
Well,
I'm like, you fucking kidding me?
Well,
so Serena can take a ball and sling it like that into the crowd. Somebody catches it. You're going to be like, oh, Ramos is going to be like, guy caught the ball.
Yeah.
So that was two. Another in the same match, Nick Kyrgios is turning around the side, mouths off something about something and says the word fucking in the middle of the sentence, mm-hmm. right? Okay. Yeah, no big deal. He's looking away from the umpire. Guess what? Linesman, who heard it, and there's kids mine, goes up to the umpire, a la Serena Williams, right? With
narc.
The line umpire.
A narc.
It goes and narcs on him. Uh-huh. Guess what? You know, as a player, as soon as you see that linesman walking up, you're like, fuck, I'm screwed, right? So he goes up, obviously tells the umpire that Nick said, swore, and the umpire looks at him, nods, and the linesman goes back. Crickets.
Nothing.
No warning.
Really?
Same umpire.
Huh.
So I'm thinking to myself, I have just seen in my week of sitting on court three blatant code violations, not a warning. So my help, and I am sitting there and I am fuming.
Yeah.
It's bullshit. It's like if you're going to have a blanket statement on if you break a racket, that's automatic. If you hit a ball into the stands like that, it's an automatic warning.
Yeah.
How is a code violation not given for those?
Yeah,
I don't understand it. So, you know, when you have these players like Serena going, I've seen worse. You know, look, Roger Federer.
Yeah.
Great guy, right? Well behaved on 99.9% of occasions.
Yeah, no, but he's
but he sat there at the US Open
and
looked at an umpire and said, don't fucking something or other.
Yeah.
Don't fucking something or other.
Yeah.
Don't fucking something or other. Like two or three times said the word fucking to the umpire.
Yeah.
Everybody heard it.
In my view, that.
Not a warning.
Yeah.
Serena says, you're a thief.
Yeah.
You stole a point from me. Warning.
The
game penalty in the final of the US Open. So I'm just saying, I know how you feel about this, Serena, but think about that for a second.
Absolutely. And to be clear, the way I feel about Serena is that she... what she said in by the letter of the law was worse was because there's literally a line that says you cannot question the integrity of an umpire.
Totally.
So that is why
a
non-cursing statement to that of that nature might not elicit something that if you drop the F-bomb. That said, no, I the point is widely now known, which is that this is totally
Nick
arbitrary.
Kyrgios was
totally
yelling
arbitrary.
Out in his match in Cincinnati, which we all know how much he got fined.
$113,000.
He was yelling out, this is literally the worst umpire in the game. He's the worst umpire in the game. He shouldn't be something or something. You're saying that he is, you know, whatever you're saying, that's the same thing.
100%, it is.
But no warning. And so it's like, look, guys, if you're going to do this, do it.
Yeah.
Do it, do it or don't do it.
Yeah.
One of the two.
Yeah.
Like, let's get on the same page here. And, you know, Ramos, everyone will say, you know, he did it by the letter of the law, blah, blah, blah. It's like, yeah, but let's know the circumstance as well.
Yeah.
And at that point, at a set in 4-3 in the women's final, it's probably time to bite your tongue.
Well, I mean, the Cincinnati thing with Nick is interesting because, you know, he won the tournament in Washington. He committed at least one offense that you saw that should have been...
Yeah, Tsitsipas did too and didn't get caught.
And also, Tsitsipas was breaking his shoes left and right and going to the stands and getting people to relace his shoes. It was kind of a fiasco.
Yeah.
What do you think about Nick's getting busted? I mean, do you think that that's...
Yeah, it was a lot.
$113,000 is a lot. I mean, this is not the first time he's gone completely apeshit.
It was a lot.
Yeah.
It was a lot. I think now he'll realize that maybe when he goes off the court to break a racket, he has to do it in the locker room and not in a place that has cameras.
Listen.
As well?
Sure.
Yeah.
I think if we're going to issue rules, which I think we should, which is nothing in the game that can be sort of put in the letter of the law should be, and also, like, it doesn't have to be this arbitrary, right? Lines are not arbitrary. The rules should not be arbitrary. This is equal application of the law based on a mutual understanding of what's going on out there. But also, I have to say, like, and this concerns juniors and the way that I think players comport themselves, which is I can't think of an instance in where turning the match into a total fiasco is good. Maybe it helps you with a modicum of intensity and help, but, like, you're getting free rackets from sponsors. If I were a racket sponsor and someone broke my rackets, I'd be peace. I'd be out.
Well,
I'd be like,
Yonex did. Remember they implemented that you're not going to get a certain amount of
rackets. You want
rackets
our shit for free? Don't break our shit.
Because Coco was doing it a lot, Vanderway, and she was on basically on notice. So, yeah, I mean, some companies have actually pulled the plug on that. But anyway, well, enough about Nick because we're going to see how he responds here at the US Open because he's going to have to win a couple matches to get the money back. But,
well, as always, I'm rooting for him.
Yeah, I mean, me too. I love Nick. Yeah. Listen.
Listen, I'm rooting for Serena,
listen,
too.
And you know what? The bottom line is...
I'm rooting for Stefanos Tsitsipas. I'm rooting for all these
guys. Nick tried his ass off in Washington, and he tried to control his
and
crazy...
And look what happened.
And it was hard for him, and he managed to do it. And he's trying. It's just he just completely lost his mind.
Yeah.
Lost his mind in Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing was that he was up a set in 6-5. He just let it go, man.
Yeah.
Just let it go.
Yeah.
Just went, you know, some people... I get it, but my biggest thing was... I might lose it, but my whole goal was I wanted to win so badly.
Yeah.
Was Nick, you know, that if he can get to the point where he wants to win so badly as opposed to wanting to be right in an argument, because
mm-hmm.
God knows I like to be right in an argument, that's where he just don't, you don't have to be right in an argument all the time on court. Do it off court. Like, go and make your point off court, which is his point was about the starting of the clock before
sure.
the serve. Anyway, so yeah, Nick got screwed there. Nick got what he deserved, and he'll admit to that. There's no question about that. Speaking of the men, let's hope Nick goes deep in the tournament because we know how fun he is to watch. But you just feel like it's just boring at this point.
The men's tournament, I mean, look, if the men's tour is incredible.
Yeah.
The men's tour in Grand Slams, where the only narrative that we have either seen or people can talk about...
The biggest story is, where is Roger going to be? Up the top or down the bottom?
Right, yeah.
That's it.
Look, snooze fest. I'm ready for somebody else. I don't care who it is. I don't care if it's, you know, Sam Querrey. I don't care if it's Danny Medvedev. I don't care if it's anybody.
I love Danny Medvedev.
I don't care if it's Sanga, who's come back from
not gonna be
nowhere.
Sanga.
Probably not going to be Sanga. But,
Medvedev can play, this guy. It's just, can these guys, these younger players, do it over best of five? I mean, Dominic Thiem has done it number of times. He just can't seem to do it back to back, right? He's beaten Djokovic in big matches.
He can
beat
one of them.
He's beaten, yeah, you can beat one of them,
but
it's beating
them
twice,
yeah.
You know, or a Roger and a Rafa or Novak. And so we'll see. I mean, I liked Thiem. I think he'll be the first one to break through just because he's knocking on the door so many times.
Yeah.
I think Daniil Medvedev loves this.
Yeah.
He loves to play.
Yeah.
He's such a fun guy. He actually enjoys the spotlight. He enjoys the fun of it. He enjoys the get down and dirty. He doesn't get too carried away. He's kind of got this like flair about him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a nice guy.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm totally rooting for him to sort of break through and maybe we can see what he can do. Best of five. Best of three is a whole different story.
Best of three. That's why I like
watching
men's tennis.
Well, wouldn't
it
be nice if we had best of three in men's tennis?
It would be great because best of three tennis is great and interesting in men and women.
Yeah, we might see some different players like breaking through.
So let me ask you a question because, you know, I've talked, you've talked ad nauseum about generation, middle of the road, right? So this is everybody who's younger than the big three, but not the super, super young guys. I'm done talking about them. The Sangas.
The millennials. We want
the
millennials.
XYs. Grigor Dimitrovs. Like, those guys are done. It's over. Milos Raonic, like, no offense to those guys. It's just, it seems unlikely.
Yeah.
But this team, Zverev,
Tsitsipas,
Felix Auger-Aliassime. Like these guys are real.
How do you say it?
Auger-Aliassime.
Is that how you say it? Or is that how you're supposed to say it?
I don't know.
I think it's Auger-Aliassime.
Fine.
Felix Auger-Aliassime. Yeah, yeah. I did say it in front of him and he goes, "Ooh, good." So I'm going to take.
All right, fine.
Okay. Speaking of
Felix.
I love him.
He's my absolute favorite.
Can I just tell you, if I wasn't a lesbian...
What? This is getting creepy. He's 18.
No, I know. I'm not saying I would go after him, but he would... That guy...
Oh, no, he's a heartthrob.
This kid is... He is such a sweetheart. He looks you in the eye when he talks to you.
He's so compelling on the court.
Oh, my God. He's got the it factor.
Yeah, he's a star.
The only problem with Felix that I feel is going to stop him is the serve. I don't know what's going on with the serve, but he has this little bit of a yippy thing with the ball toss. And
well, he's got a big kick, right?
He's got a great serve when he gets the rhythm. He's got to find his rhythm. I don't know what's going on with it, but
the toss kind of travels.
18 and 19, you cannot have the yips already, man. You get that when you're 28 or 35, and you're like, fuck, is this the last year of my life? No. So that's a bit of a concern for me. I don't know if it's mental or what's going on, but that he needs to fix that. And I don't know how you fix that, because we all remember Anna Ivanovic with the ball toss or, you know, Dementieva, and we've seen them, right?
Yeah, it's tragic. You get into a tragic headspace. The serve in particular, I mean, it's just so...
Oh, and it's so big in men's tennis. I mean, so let's hope he gets that under control, because if he does, God,
Felix
is
a star.
He's
so compelling to watch.
And he's so nice, and he gets the respect.
I'm having a
Felix love fest. I love him.
That's great. I mean, no argument here.
Good.
While we're talking about young Canadians,
BB
Andreescu.
Yeah, what a crazy story. Huh?
I mean, look, I did not think it was a fluke when she went to Indian Wells and tore everybody up.
Yeah.
Only because you kind of watched her for a couple of years and you thought, oh, what an interesting. She's got the strike force alpha. You know,
well, tell you what she does really
well.
But she
also has variety in a really smart way. She's a thinker.
She is very smart on the court. She is not thinking, I'm going to overpower. She goes, no, you know what? I'm going to use my really good forehand, which is heavy with spin, which you don't see often on the women's tour. You get a lot of balls that are hit pretty flat.
Yeah.
You know, when you think about the top players, Serena, Halep, Pliskova... I mean, Barty has variety, which is why she does so well as well. With not huge weapons, but really solid. BB's the same. She has this heavy forehand. She has a pretty flattish backhand, but then she throws these crazy drop shots and forehand slices. And that's a Romanian coming out in her, right? That sort of like nutty Romanian style of tennis, like a little Niculescu-esque.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, she also does what she will not allow anyone to call moon balls, but we would call them moon balls back in my day. She calls it an offensive topspin ball, which it is, but it's a different kind.
It's a changeup, is
what
it is.
It's a changeup, exactly.
She has a changeup
high.
And
then all of a sudden she's getting you out of your hit zone. It's, it's genius.
She's smart. She just recognizes, look, I could go toe-to-toe, but I'm probably not going to win that way all the time.
Yeah.
So I'm going to throw in a few of this and a little bit of that and a little pepper, a little cayenne, and then all of a sudden she throws in a drop shot. And then
she's got hands and she can react well to the net.
She's quick. Yeah. And so she's smart and she's patient. And what a fucking great story. I mean, she wins Indian Wells and she bloody goes off with the shoulder and the this and the that injury and this injury, and then comes back and wins bloody tournament in Canada, which, other than a Grand Slam, is the biggest win of her, is going to be the biggest win of her
hometown crowd. I mean, it's crazy. Well, I also just
and she's fun. She's got a fun attitude.
Like Felix, they both are like very sort of optimistic, smiley. You know, they
she's a little bit of a drama queen on the court, and I love her. But it's like
see where she gets it from.
Well, yeah.
Have you seen her mom?
She's Romanian.
Have you seen her mom in the crowd? Her mom has like a lone parasol of one with sunglasses on 24/7, even at night matches.
That's the Romanian coming out there, right? She's a little nutty, you know. Then she's a little dramatic, but you know what? Good for her. I mean, she's young, and so the way she's handled this pressure is pretty bloody great. And she's not lost a match against a top 10 player.
That's nuts.
Ever.
I don't think that's a stat.
I don't think that's ever happened.
Could exist in
There's no way that's ever happened.
That's nuts.
There's no way. Anyway, so she's a really exciting young talent as well. She's really, look, she can really possibly do some damage.
Listen, you know what I think she has? BDE.
Big Dick Energy.
Did it.
Wow. That's amazing.
Did it.
Big Dick Energy. All right. Well, as a woman, good for her.
all right. What else do we need to
We want to touch upon just a little sad story. Was Anisimova's dad passed away just before the US Open, so she had to pull out of the tournament. Really great up-and-coming young American. So, you know, we wish her all the best in her family, and, you know, tennis will be here for a really long time, but obviously...
She's 19. Take your obviously, time, come back. Obviously, that's a really sad thing to happen.
And her dad was her coach, so, you know, we hope that she can sort of have the time away and realize that, look, there's going to be a lot more US Opens, but, you know, sadly, she only has one dad, so that was a really sad story coming to the US Open, so we wish her all the best. You know, when you think about that a little bit, we had Noah Rubin was talking recently on his podcast about sort of the tough side of tennis, and he brought up the fact that there was a lot of alcohol abuse and maybe, you know, various different things going on. Look, there's no doubt that there are players that go into massive depressions when they're playing. Mm-hmm. You know, I tend to disagree with him on the alcoholic abuse mm-hmm. situation. I mean, you can't be a professional athlete and get on the sauce like every time you lose. I mean, that's just... You can't,
Jack Sock, you can't.
Well, there are some that do, for sure. If you're in the top 10, it's not happening.
Yeah.
I can tell you that for a fact.
Yeah.
There's no top player.
No, but just to interrupt you, I mean, I think behind the racket, which is Noah Rubin, who is an American ranked, what was he, about 120 in the world, something like that? He kind of fluctuates between like 80 and 150. Yeah. You know, he has this digital platform behind the racket where he talks about sort of the hidden sides or sort of, you know, a lot of it focuses on mental...
Health
and, you know...
Well, unhealthy.
And unhealth in this case. But talking a lot about basically what a grind it is for a lot of players.
It's a grind.
Especially outside the top 10. And so, yeah, you can't be top 10 and be hitting the sauce. But I think more his point is a lot of other people who are sort of down towards, you know, where he is in the rankings are coping in some cases in a healthy way or not.
Because they're dealing with, like, should I be doing this anymore? And I'm not making any money and this and that. And maybe they should stop drinking. That would help them to actually...
I thought you might make that comment.
Just saying. Okay. You know, now that I'm a casual drinker on a casual of daily occasions, you can't do it. It's too hard. So I think the thing I want to stress more is less about the alcohol abuse and all that sort of stuff. I think it's more about the depression side of tennis.
Well, because alcohol is a coping mechanism for something that's deeper.
100%. So you are going to have some people that are dealing with that. But I think overall it's more about how difficult the life is. And every week you lose. I mean, you're a loser every week. That's how you feel. Even though you win a match, you have that high.
Yeah.
I mean, I've always said that...
only one person wins a tournament. I mean, just the truth of it is 50% of people lose on the first day. That's just something you have to
deal with
every single time you go out there.
It's legal addiction.
Yeah.
Is what I call being a professional athlete.
Interesting.
You know, it's legal addiction. And you have that high, and then you have that really quick low, and it's just brutal, and the low lasts, you know, days, and you're just depressed, you don't want to leave your room, you think you suck, you're never going to be good enough. I mean, it all goes on in your head. And then you just got to pick yourself back up and get on with it. It's kind of like getting broken up with every week. You just got to get on with it, you know, and find a way to find that passion again to get up on the practice court. You'll be seeing a lot of players dealing with it, particularly at the end of the year, this last Grand Slam. It means a lot to these players. So overall, look, we're going into the US Open with some great storylines once again with the women's tour. Who's going to win? Flip a coin. Will Madison Keys break through and win a Grand Slam? Will Karolina Pliskova break through and win a Grand Slam? I mean, these are the sort of the questions. Will Bibi Andreescu have the year of her life?
Yeah.
Can Ash Barty win two slams?
What about my girl Sabalenka? Maybe she'll find
Sabalenka
her
is
towards the end
an
of
interesting
year.
Situation because she really looked like she was going to be the Naomi Osaka last year and break through and win a slam because she was playing so well. And then all of a sudden, she's had a bit of a rough year. She's played a little better over the last couple of weeks. But Jesus Christ, she has a tough first round. She plays Azarenka in the first round, and poor old Vika can't catch a break with the draws. So one of them's going to break through, and maybe if whoever wins that match can get through to a quarterfinal.
There's some insane first-round matchups. Obviously, we talked about Maria Serena, which I don't think will be, to your point, a very
competitive
tennis match, but certainly doesn't lack for
it's compelling.
Some drop. It's compelling. You got, as you just noted, the two Belarusians against each other. You got Coco Vandeweghe, who we always like to see well because I love her game all quarter.
But she's struggling. She plays Kenin first round.
She plays Kenin first round, which is really tough. A young American who went deep in a couple of slams.
Who I love.
That's great.
Talk about a great competitor.
Just firecracker. And then another match that I love because I'm a nerd is Angelique Kerber, Kristina Mladenovic.
Oh, yeah, that's
going to
be a good one.
That'll be a good one, too.
Well, because Angie struggles sometimes in the first round. She gets a little bit nervous and she doubts herself a little bit and she doesn't have those big weapons. So sometimes if she has a bit of a tight day, that Mladenovic can take advantage of that.
Yeah, Mladenovic is like an emotional player. She's got a lot of tools. She really
hasn't had a great couple of weeks, though, leading into the US Open either. So it's kind of a battle of who can muster the confidence to, you know, break it down.
But I have to say this,
a lot
though.
Of great matches.
I mean, we've talked a lot about recognizable names, but for me, truly, and this is something I love so much about having a slam in our backyard, which is just I cannot get over how fun like the first 5 days are. For me, nothing is more fun than the beginning couple days of a tournament, and especially the beginning couple days of a slam, because you just turn around and then there's some other insane match going on, or it's to your right, or oh my god, there's a crazy barn burner third set going on court 17, let's all get out there. And what's so great is that, you know, if you do have a chance to go to the tournament, don't go to Ash. Go to the grounds and just walk around.
Definitely don't go to Ash in the first like 2 or 3 days, because they're usually blowouts. You've got the top seeds playing against people that don't even know how to walk onto Ash, don't even know where Arthur Ashe Stadium is half the time. So, yeah, the best matches are, you know, often the best matches like Grandstand.
Yeah.
Or maybe Louis Armstrong now.
Totally.
That's, and Louis Armstrong is like a not a reserve seat a lot of times. So
Louis
you can
Armstrong
get some great.
The best, one of the
that's
best
a great. That's,
alone,
I would
facility.
Just sit there
it's
the
amazing.
Whole time.
Yeah,
because you
place.
Often get really good matchups there. Grandstand, of course, is always notoriously the Grandstand tends to be, so for you out there that are going to the Open, Grandstand's usually the matchups that really like a whoa, like an Azarenka, Sabalenka.
Yeah.
Like a Felix Auger Aliassime is playing
like
Shapovalov.
Like a fan favorite.
Yeah.
Like the players.
It's the
choice.
Match that everyone
it's the match
goes
that's,
ooh.
Everyone knows is gonna go the distance,
ooh.
Whether or not the rankings are enough
exactly.
of a blockbuster. But it's one that real tennis fans know, okay, we're gonna get to
it'll
it
be Coco Vandeweghe Kennen match.
Exactly.
Like those
something like
sort
that.
Of matchups. That it's usually where you'll put players on Grandstand.
Yeah.
So that's a fun so
insider tip.
Yeah, we're looking forward to it, Caitlin. We can't wait. I'm gonna be very busy.
Yes.
In between my ESPN duties, which you know how much I love working for them, and I feel really lucky and blessed that I get to do that job for a living. But I also now am a little responsible for my buddy Sam Stosur, so let's all get behind her and we'll see what happens. And in the meantime, let's hope one thing we won't be seeing is Mr. Ramos in a chair with Serena Williams playing a match that has been designated a no-go zone.
Yep, exactly.
Thank God. And just to tip off everybody, players are allowed to ask to not have certain umpires in their chair. It doesn't happen very often. Another Twitter war I had over the last couple of weeks. I played 22 years on the professional tour, and I asked for 3 umpires to not be in my chair over that time, and they were not put in my chair after that. And one was the last one was an umpire told me shit happens on the court, and I didn't take too kindly to that. So I requested that umpire never to be in my chair again.
And
often it's because some umpires are a little bit combative as well. And I kind of had that combative personality. Oh, I didn't need someone on the court being combative with me who was the umpire who needed to be calming me down.
Makes sense.
So that's sort of what happened there. I had a German guy in the chair one time who was just, I felt was just a dick. And I just didn't want him in the chair. And I had problems with him on the court. So it happened. So, you know, the fact that Serena may have asked for that then or not, I don't think she asked for it, to be perfectly honest with you. Umpires can also ask to not be in.
Well, if I was him, I wouldn't blame him. I'm going to be on US Open Radio doing the podcast almost every day, and you can buy the latest issue of Racquet Magazine in the bookstore of the Grandstand. So if you want to get your hands on it, find Ms. Mary Carrillo, who contributed to our piece about Vitas Gerulaitis.
Yeah, Vitas Gerulaitis, 25th year this year of his death. One of the true characters and gentlemen and great guys of this sport, sadly died in a tragic incident where he was basically killed with carbon monoxide poisoning.
Brutal.
Go and grab the magazine. It's tits, as we say. It
tits.
Looks amazing.
There's some actual tits in it. We got the drag queens of Holding Court TV.
Are those tits or are those fake tits?
It doesn't matter. They're going to be on the ground, so if you see a tall Arena Katrinka drag queens walking around, go get them to autograph your issue. Nick McCarville wrote a great piece about them. We got a throwback to Monica Seles and Jennifer Capriati. You know, it's a good time. And it's just in time for the US Open.
It's
so,
a beautiful mag.
Go grab one.
It looks good.
Listen out for Renee. And
I'll be there.
Come say hi.
Come say hi. I'll be on the
ESPN
desk out on the Fountain Plaza every single day out there. So come say hi and bring your racket gear and we'll sign it. Maybe the magazine and I'll sign the magazine.
All right.
Thanks,
Caitlin. Let's do another one in the middle of the week.
I'll
if we have time.
See you in the middle of the week and I'll see what players I can grab. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Keep questions coming.
We love you. Bye.
And that's it for this episode of the Racquet Magazine podcast. Thanks for listening. Our host is Renee Stubbs. Our co-host and producer is me, Caitlin Thompson. Music by internationally renowned DJ Stretch Armstrong. Thanks to Tim Ruggieri and the team at Acast. Find us at racketmag.com/podcast and subscribe to us at any of your favorite podcatchers.